This is Jason Scott. You're listening to the Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It podcast, a podcast about history, technology, and getting myself out of debt. Thanks to Daniel Boyd, Jeff Atwood, and the hundreds of other Patreon supporters who have helped make this podcast possible. I've been really lucky the last couple of decades, really, where people have given me a tip or invited me somewhere, and they've told me that there is something I should see. And I'll drive hundreds of miles or hours on end to end up somewhere to see the thing that people thought I should see. And I've stood outside buildings, shipping containers, storage units, homes, and then the door opens or the door rolls up, or in some way I walk into a wonderland of old stuff. Just this week, I had to deal with an emergency situation that luckily didn't actually need me, but it reminded me how some people may or may not know about these kinds of windfalls or experiences that happen in a world where our lore and our history can be defined in small boxes or piles of paper or pieces of technology. What does it mean when you realize that you may be the only step between a piece of history existing for a few decades longer or utterly disappearing into oblivion? So for this episode, I'm just going to focus on a couple stories of stuff that I've had to deal with over the course of the last few years in my role as the Angel of Death. I'm known for doing things with websites. Now, the thing with websites is that, with the exceptions of ones that have weird backends that are obscured and shadowy, most of them are just simply collections of static data. You know, you go to a website for a restaurant that's closing, it'll have a menu or it'll have some description of what they're serving or the history of the restaurant, and it'll all fit into a surprisingly small package, you know, maybe 20, 30 megabytes. It's all very easy to find. Everything links to everything else. Really, that's why at the archive team, we basically have an automated process called the archive bot to do most of this work. But it's very different when it comes to physical material. It's not a world where you can just pop up into somebody's house because you teleported there 10 seconds ago. What you do is you get contacted or you get a tip, and from there come the steps of finding out the value of what you're about to engage with. So it's those kind of calls that come in where somebody will write to me and say, "I just found out this is going away. What can you do?" That's where I take steps. So here's how that would go. Recently, I got contacted by somebody who let me know about an ongoing situation in an abandoned office building in Audubon, Pennsylvania. Now, Audubon, Pennsylvania happens to be the home of MOS Technology. That's the company that made the 6502 chip and was eventually purchased by Commodore. And this site was closed in 2001 for EPA violations, Environmental Protection Agency violations. It had not cleaned itself up from all of the chip fabrication that had been done. It was basically toxic and unusable. But it turned out that a new owner had purchased the building in 2017 and was cleaning it up to be demolished and then building new property over it. And the contractor who was sent in to clear out the contents of this old abandoned building found in multiple rooms that there was Commodore equipment. And he had some sort of inkling that this was in some way vintage and important, and that there was some community out there that probably wanted it. So he showed up on a few vintage forums with pictures he had taken of the piles, and this caused kind of a panic. There were things in the pile really blew people away, you know, old fab wafers and magnetic tapes and papers and what looked like some sort of prototype computers or maybe modified original Commodore computers. I remember this place had not been Commodore in over 25 years and had been a whole other company for something like 10 before they were shut down. And so everybody just kind of fell into the frothing, feeding frenzy of, oh my God, this history, this one-of-a-kind example is going to disappear. And the contractor had no idea what he was up against with this. I was contacted somewhere like a week into this, and I called the contractor up and talked to him around midnight. And he told me he had thrown out 12 dumpsters worth of stuff before he had even really gotten into this whole computer bit, and that he understood it might have some value, but he wasn't sure, and how fast could I get down there, and others were looking at it, but were they serious? And, you know, in that kind of a situation, you can kind of build up a narrative in your mind that there's one shot to get this, and if it goes away, it's all gone. And it felt that way with the Commodore equipment because, my goodness, a vault of old Commodore history was on its way out. Now, it turns out that there's plenty of people who have the skills and the ability to get down to that building. There were people from the Vintage Computer Federation who showed up. There was a wonderful ex-employee named Bill Hurd who actually co-designed the Commodore 128. He showed up. They looked at the equipment. They looked at the materials. They asked to borrow some of them, and the contractor was more than nice about it. He let them borrow it. But somewhere in the middle of that, he suddenly decided, you know, maybe I should eBay this. And so everything's kind of hit a weird standstill. Now, when I'm describing this all to you, I'm saying this is all happening within 48 hours. This is all very fast. This is phone calls back and forth. This is me dropping emails. This is others posting to forums and sharing pictures. And while the outcome of this particular transaction is still up in the air, you can see all the pieces in place, right? I mean, we all know that computer history is in many ways valuable. It is these artifacts, these physical artifacts, either engineering notes or old magnetic data or prototypes or documentation, and it's so easy to shove it off into a folder or a storage unit and then forget about it. And yet, when you find it again, it gives you such insights into the thinking behind products that have changed the world. You know, things about the Commodore 64 or the workings of the 6502 chip or projects that never came to fruition. You know, these are jewels to somebody who wants to understand a period of time. There's no question the collection sells itself. But let's step back from the froth of the current Commodore situation. I'll have people who are sitting on boxes of floppy disks or old cassettes. And usually for folks, it's either in the middle of a cleaning or a realization that somebody sees value in these piles of plastic discs and artifacts from so long ago. And they'll contact me, and the question is pretty basic. Like, what do I do next? You know, because a lot of people kind of think in their minds, I should turn these floppies into data. I'm glad that people have internalized that. But then they're not sure where they're going to get this kind of floppy drive. They're not sure if they can keep track of what things were. They don't know how to read them if they were to actually extract the data out. You know, they're kind of in a standstill. And it's been my effort and the effort of many others over the course of the last few years to just make it as easy as possible to just ship a pile of floppies to a location. And a few dozen times in this year alone, people have mailed me collections of floppies, and then I go through them, and I look at them, and I try to figure out what's on them, and I turn them into disk images, and then any ones I can't read, I then give over to a number of specialists, including 4AM and the C64 tape archivist and Kevin Savitz and many others who have the stuff right there ready to go if I can't do anything with it. It's kind of interesting to watch 4,000 floppies become 10 or 20 megabytes worth of data and then mailing the stuff back to people, telling them, thank you, you did it, your story's over. You've got the data in a zip file I was able to attach to the mail. Other times, it gets more complicated. You'll have a collector. Collectors, well, there's a lot of positives and negatives to really dedicated collectors. You get people who really fall in love with a certain kind of company or a certain kind of genre, and they go out and they start buying up examples of that company or genre. And they get through the standard stuff pretty quickly, and then they start finding that instead of spending $5 or $10 for an item, they're having to spend $50 or $60 or $100 for an item. And then it gets into the $500, the $1,000, the multi-thousand. And now your relationship to this history is a little different. Maybe you're not as quick to mail it out to some weirdo in New York to have him image it. Maybe you've convinced yourself that imaging it will ruin the value. You know, we'll take this rare item and make it redundant. Maybe you should hold back on the quote-unquote good stuff. Or maybe, and I'm happy to say many of them have been like this, you will do it, but we have to send you the equipment to image it so it never leaves your home. People have the boxes and the documentation, and it's great when they can scan it and take the time to turn it into a zip file or a CBZ file and send it along. Sometimes it's adequate just to take photos of some really strange figurine, you know, just to prove that it existed. We don't know what we're going to do with this imagery and this data going forward. I mean, it's easy enough to say that with floppies and with computer printouts, we're able to just make them into a PDF or make them into a ROM file that plays in an emulator. But in other times, it's not really clear what the advantage of putting this massive piece of equipment up is. Like, you're probably not going to run it again. You know, there's equipment that you just can't run in a regular home because of the power consumption. And even if you were to, you'd be spending an incredible amount of money on it. You know, Brewster, my boss, was one of the co-designers on something called a connection machine made by Thinking Machines Corporation. And like many people, he has one. It's sitting in his warehouse. I pass it all the time. Problem is, you know, nobody's going to run this thing. Recently, a museum purchased a different connection machine, not his, and they basically have mocked it up so that its lights all work because it had amazing lights. But the interest in having it functionally run is basically nil at this point. Like, the world would not want that. At best, you might want to take what it does and turn it into theories that run on an FPGA or some modern machine. You wouldn't want to go back to the power of multiple dishwashers running at full while someone arc welds down the hallway to be able to add 1 plus 1 on 256 different CPU cores. Its time as a functional tool is over. Maybe its time as a demonstrative item may never end. I mean, a connection machine, when it's running, and it's a beautiful thing to watch. It's definitely a work of art. And this extends to machines that are even older than a connection machine. You know, the Living Computer Museum in Seattle has a beautiful collection of mainframes that they have meticulously restored such that they do run. You actually can go there and see a real mainframe actively working. It's an incredible expense, both in time and money and power, but it's so great that somebody is actually doing this and actually trying to make them live a little bit longer. But that won't always be the case. The expense of bringing a machine like that back to life, a machine that at its time was worth tens of millions of dollars and could cost you thousands of inflation-adjusted dollars, we don't need that. That's not going to happen. That's not what we would call future-proof. Recently, a collection of Amiga computers that had been given to me by Len Tower Jr., one of the co-founders of the Free Software Foundation, found its way to California, where one of my colleagues, Tim, went through these very old Amigas. This was like an Amiga 3000, an Amiga 2000, that had been living and running in the early 90s. His job was to somehow bring them back to life. It turned out it was a really complicated situation. When Len had finished with those machines at the Free Software Foundation and needed to store them, he put them in a barn. I mean, that's what he had. So they went in a barn. And then they went from his house in Boston all the way to my home in New York, where they sat for another 10 years not doing anything. So by the time Tim got them, Tim was analyzing data they had on them, and he found cases of rust and places where battery acid had leaked out, and he was surprisingly able to get data off of a lot of the hard drives. But some of the machines were basically good for parts and nothing else. And I don't really cry for these machines. I mean, they were destined to be thrown out, and they weren't thrown out. And so being able to at least get the data off them was better than nothing. And actually, to be honest, it's better than nothing is the refrain of a lot of what we have to deal with in the world of saving old history. But getting back to these caches of materials, probably the big one that everyone knows about related to me is the big manual warehouse safe. And I've written many blog entries about it, so I don't want to go into too much detail here, but basically there was a business that had been selling manuals, and they were one of the largest manual sellers in the world, Manuals Plus. And Manuals Plus was one of multiple businesses that the owner was running, and he was moving his building, and he just didn't want to spend the money. He figured it was something like $200,000 to move all of this material to a brand new climate-controlled location. So he was going to dump it. And I got a tip off, and I showed up, and with the help of dozens of volunteers on the ground and many more dozens dropping money, I was able to oversee the rescuing of something like 75,000 manuals, many of which aren't anywhere else in the world. And just the process of going through a massive warehouse and then putting all of the remaining items into banker boxes that then went into a storage unit set, and then that storage unit set moving to a mall and an unused store, and then going from that unused store and then being shipped to California, where they are now all sitting inside of shipping containers inside of a warehouse in California. I mean, that was a major operation. I think I can only sustain those cost-wise and time-wise maybe a handful of times in my life going forward. I mean, it will have to be something really out there to get my attention. It's just no way around it. It's just so much effort. But more often than not, it'll simply be something like a pile of boxes. Somebody will have 10 or 15 or 20 boxes that they kept in their home from when they were a ham radio operator, or when they ran a computer store, or when they were some sort of operator for a technical endeavor. And now they're thinking about getting rid of it, or even more sadly, their descendants are trying to come up with what to do with it. And I find that people are very open to just having it all get hauled away as long as they know it's going to a home that will make sense. Let me tangentially say that there is unfortunately a narrative in all this where people try to figure out what's the value. And I mean not in terms of history. I mean like the pure mercenary idea that somebody has some old item, a bobblehead, a chip, a piece of documentation, an autographed item, and they think that it may be worth a lot of money, and that where possible, they would like to be able to go on to the Antiques Roadshow and turn something that they didn't do anything for, that just lay around in their lives or that fell into their lap, and turn it into cash. And that thinking, while definitely wonderful for somebody who's looking for dreams to find, just gets in the way of the work I do. I always make clear that when I take stuff from people, I'm not going to turn around and eBay it and split it apart and turn it into nothing. You know, I was contacted by a collector last week because I have been uploading thousands of CD-ROMs that people have been sending me or that I've had, and one of them was a beta version of a program that was sent to a games magazine. And I had scanned it and taken the data off of it and put it up on the archive. And this person wanted to buy it. And I was trying to explain it's not for sale. And he was explaining to me about how he collects things associated with this game. And isn't it better if the item were in the hands of a collector who appreciated it instead of an anonymous archive? And I was like, no. My counteroffer is no. And after a while, I literally had to block him. I mean, he was really trying to wear me down. So no, I don't really buy into the whole money thing. And as soon as somebody starts to bring up money, I basically have to kick into a mode that I never like, which I call dumpster minus one. When I found out that the Chicago Sun-Times were going to dump something like 15 file cabinets full of promotional movie material, I showed up and got into their phones and up and down the line, talking from their CEO all the way down to an editor who was in charge of those file cabinets, and basically explained, look, I'll take them away. I have no interest in this material beyond maybe scanning some of it. And I simply am offering to be the last stop before you throw it in a dumpster. Now, as it turned out, that worked out nicely. There was a university that has all of Roger Ebert's archives, and many of these pictures in the Chicago Sun-Times archives had been used by Roger Ebert for the movies that he reviewed. So it was wonderful that they actually went and got paired up with the rest of his work, a much more complete vision. So that had a happy ending. But I was more than willing to be that dumpster minus one. And people out there will have material and they just don't want the trouble of trying to come up with metadata and analysis and in some way curating it for the benefit of some institutional body. I was contacted by an institution asking, so what's your secret? And I don't think it's much of a secret. My secret is I tend to say yes. I tend to say, okay, I'm definitely going to take this. I just have to work with you to figure out when, where, how, and where's it going to go. And other places will make people jump through hoops for the purposes of donating things. In fact, some will even request that you give them money for the pleasure of them taking the item. And I know there's all sorts of professional arguments for this, but what it means is a lot of stuff will end up in oblivion. Looking forward, the hunt continues. The archive is humming along in terms of absorbing collections. I am being sent lots of software, lots of floppy disks, lots of books, and I have been putting them into the maw of our warehouse and preparing them for additional sorting and turning them into, eventually, digital forms while then storing permanently the non-digital versions of those forms. And it's going to be an exciting bunch of years coming forward. I love announcing to people what we've stumbled on or something that people have acquired or that was inside of a closet somewhere, forgotten until just last month. And now we can bring to you all of these great things that somebody didn't know they had. It's a wonderful, alluring story, and I want to keep telling it. It never gets old for me. I want something that's out there that brightens people's day. It's a way of really extending life when you think about it. A person looks back and figures out what influenced them, what colors and sounds and promises made them what they are. And the fuzzy memory, while in its own way artistically beautiful, I think can be helped by having the original source material and making the stories that you tell about how these things influenced you even richer and more accurate and better documented in a way that maybe you'll inspire others to find dreams that they forgot or make new dreams or become kids again by experiencing the wonder that is computer and technology and human history. You've been listening to Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It. I'm Jason Scott. Thanks to James Bakoyanu, Sam Johnston, Stefan Arendts, Astrid Smith, and Mark Pilgrim, along with the hundreds of other Patreon supporters who help this podcast come to life and provide a way for me to work my way out of debt. Just earlier this week, I went to the dentist. Doesn't sound like much, but I haven't been to the dentist all that much. I had some really horrifying experiences in my teens. I had a dentist who, he put 16 fillings into me in less than 6 months, and I hated dentists. And so I stopped going with any regularity. But with the heart attack, it was a realization that maybe I have to take care of myself a little better. And luckily, I only have a cavity and a filling to fix, but the fact that they said to me how much it would cost, which worked out to a few hundred bucks, didn't scare me in the least, because this Patreon has helped me have a cushion of money so that a few hundred extra dollars that weren't expected from the last week they don't cause the panic that they used to. Without the panic, I don't get paralyzed. Without being paralyzed, I'm able to work on more things. I'm able to upload more items. I'm able to write more blog entries. I'm able to engage with folks and help save this history. So you are helping me there, and I'm never forgetting that. Thanks so much. And if you're listening to this podcast for the first time, the Patreon is at patreon.com/textfiles. Thanks again to everybody for changing my life.